Welcome to the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, November 11th, 2025. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, your guide, and I'm ready to dive into the critical developments shaping, well, everything really, from global politics to the market floor.
And I'm Sam Astor, your expert guest. I'm here to help connect those dots and make sense of what's really going on behind the headlines in this incredibly complex news cycle.
Yeah, complex is the word. Our mission today is, frankly, comprehensive. We've taken the entire paper politics, global stuff, financials, the works, and we're aiming to distill it into an exhaustive, detailed review.
Think of it as your shortcut. You get to be completely, thoroughly well-informed without needing, you know, hours and a magnifying glass for the fine print.
Exactly. And today's paper, it really screams of institutional stress, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You've got this political infighting in D.C., a sort of two-speed economy creating divides, and even a pivotal Supreme Court showdown. That one could actually redefine the limits of presidential power.
That's the key theme, I think, for this deep dive. Institutional fragility. We're watching things kind of fray or face resistance across Washington Congress, the judiciary, and then there's this economic division that's creating some fundamental instability in the U.S. consumer base.
So to really get a full picture of this moment, where do we start? It has to be Washington, right?
Mm.
With the shutdown drama.
Absolutely. That's where the chaos has been most visible. We have to start with the government shutdown resolution, or maybe attempted resolution.
Okay, let's unpack that. It feels less like a solution and more like, I don't know, a temporary truce in a much longer legislative war. So late Sunday night, the Senate finally cleared that last procedural hurdle.
Yeah, the final one. It allowed the spending package, the one designed to end the government shutdown, to actually advance.
Which is a huge deal, obviously.
It's an enormous breakthrough, and it felt like it took forever to get here. The measure passed the Senate 60-40, I believe, and now it heads over to the GOP-controlled House.
Right, for a final vote, possibly as early as Wednesday.
That's the timeline, yes. And critically, the White House supports it. So passage into law seems almost certain now, which would finally end the shutdown that's been disrupting federal operations since, what, October 1st?
Feels longer. But the cost of getting this done wasn't just about budgets, was it? It was intensely political, especially inside the Democratic caucus.
Oh, yeah.
We saw this furious internal reaction really aim squarely at the 8 Democratic caucus members who broke ranks. They sided with Republicans to get the bill moving.
Yeah, and this is where that institutional stress you mentioned really flares up.
Who were the defectors again?
Well, there were 8 in total. It included Angus King, the independent from Maine, plus 7 Democrats. Let's see, Senators John Fetterman, Jean Shaheen, Maggie Hassan, Dick Durbin, Tim Kaine, Jackie Rosen, and Catherine Cortez Masto.
Okay.
And their argument, which they repeated in, you know, multiple interviews, was basically just pragmatic. They said the shutdown was causing real accelerating pain for the public, and they just couldn't keep holding out for some kind of perfect deal.
What specific pain points pushed them over the edge? What were they hearing from back home?
They listed a few critical things that were really hitting a breaking point. First, those massive air traffic disruptions. You know, not having key people work was causing daily chaos, hitting businesses, travelers, everyone.
Right. Airports were a mess.
Exactly. Yeah. And second, the really dire threat to SNFP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Food aid for over 40 million people was genuinely at risk of stopping within days. That could mean widespread hunger, social instability. They felt the leverage gained by letting that happen just wasn't worth the human cost.
Okay, so they felt they had to act, but what did they actually get in return from the Republicans for breaking ranks? The reporting suggests it was pretty minimal, which explains the anger from the progressive wing.
It was, let's say, a modest political win. They secured a guaranteed vote on extending the Affordable Care Act health subsidies. That vote has to happen by the second week of December.
A guaranteed vote, not a guaranteed outcome.
Precisely. Senator King, for instance, framed it as a necessary win for the American people because the immediate goal of forcing bigger concessions hadn't worked out and the shutdown was just hurting their constituents.
This choice, though, ease the immediate pain versus maintain maximum political resistance. It really just blew open that rift within the party, didn't it?
It absolutely crystallized that classic agonizing tension for any minority party leader. The base, especially after some good election cycles recently, they want energetic resistance. They want leaders to hold a firm moral line.
Sure.
But those senators facing really tangible harm, back home, airport chaos, food aid cuts, they're naturally more inclined to compromise just to stop the bleeding. When it became clear they weren't going to force major concessions, the centrists decided, well, the only thing the shutdown was achieving now was pain.
And the theory from the liberal side,
yeah,
it's been intense.
Oh, yeah. progressive groups like Indivisible, Our Revolution, they came out swinging. Influential figures like Representative Ro Khanna, California Governor Gavin Newsom, they publicly called it a capitulation.
Khanna even called for Schumer to resign, right?
He did. A very public demand saying Schumer is no longer effective and should be replaced, which is kind of the ultimate political paradox here.
How so?
Because Schumer himself actually led the resistance. He voted against advancing the bill, arguing it didn't do enough on health care.
But he still gets the blame.
He still gets the blowback. It just shows how incredibly difficult it is for Democratic leadership. They need to satisfy the base's demand for maximum resistance, but they also have to, you know, perform the basic function of governing, keep the lights on. It was a no-win situation, really, and it's definitely damaged internal party unity.
Okay, let's zoom in on the actual deal itself. Functionally, it funds the government through January 30th. So It basically just pushes the next funding fight about 2.5 months down the road.
Wait, it kicks the can.
But what immediate good does it do? What actually gets turned back on?
The immediate good is crucial, especially for people directly affected. It includes three full-year funding bills, which is great for stability for veterans programs, military housing construction, and the agriculture department.
Okay, full-year funding is better than stopgap.
Definitely. And most importantly, for the millions hit by the shutdown, federal workers will get paid. And those critical safety nets, especially SNLMP, they'll be fully restored right away. No more delays.
There was some late-night drama around SNLMP just before the deal, wasn't there? Something with the courts.
There was. A federal appeals court had actually denied the administration's attempt to withhold full food assistance benefits for November. The court said the government had to make the payments within 48 hours unless the Supreme Court stepped in.
Wow.
But the Senate deal made that whole legal fight moot, thankfully. So benefits are fully restored, avoiding another whole layer of legal and social chaos.
We also have to touch on how the administration handled the air traffic controllers. Their absence caused so much of that disruption we talked about. It seemed like a mix of carrot and stick.
It was a very hardline approach, almost punitive in one way, but then this odd incentive on the other. On one hand, the administration threatened to dock the pay of any controllers who didn't immediately return to work once the Senate voted.
Death dance.
Very. But on the other hand, there was a sort of conciliatory gesture, an offer of $10,000 bonuses for controllers who didn't take time off during the shutdown, kind of acknowledging the intense stress and workload they faced.
And the disruption itself, the scale of it?
It's just staggering. The FAA ordered traffic restrictions at 40 major airports. By Monday evening, the ripple effects meant over 2,000 scheduled flights were canceled. More than 5,500 were delayed.
And that's on top of any weather issues.
Exactly. You compound that with bad weather, and the system basically ground to a halt. And that immediate, really tangible pain is probably the single biggest reason why those 8 Democratic senators risked the wrath of their base to break ranks and end it.
Okay, so from the legislative mess and the executive actions, let's shift to the highest court. We need to talk about Chief Justice John Roberts. The paper describes him facing maybe the defining challenge of his third decade leading the Supreme Court.
Yeah, it's about defining the boundaries of President Trump's executive power, specifically around those global tariffs he imposed.
This sounds like it could be huge. An institutional earthquake, as you put it earlier.
Potentially, yes. Roberts is known as a staunch institutionalist, right? He cares deeply about the court's legitimacy. Historically, he's often granted the president pretty wide latitude on policies, often citing emergency powers or national security.
But something shifted with the tariffs.
It appears so. The recent hearing about these global tariffs, the ones justified under national security claims, well, it revealed a pretty serious shift in the court's mood, according to the reporting.
What was the general feeling among the justices?
The reporting suggests a majority of them, liberals and conservatives, strongly hinted that they think the president acted beyond his legal authority under federal law. If that feeling holds up in the final ruling, it would be the first really significant systemic blow from the Supreme Court against this president's executive authority in over 5 years. The implications here go way beyond just tariffs. They touch the core of separation of powers.
Let's dig into the legal stakes here.
Mm-hmm.
If the court rules against the president, the core issue is likely this thing called the non-delegation doctrine.
Right. That's precisely the legal lever. The administration has leaned heavily on the 1974 Trade Act. That law gives the president power to impose tariffs if imports threaten national security.
Okay.
But critics argue that grant of authority is just so broad, it violates the non-delegation doctrine. That's the principle that Congress can't just give away its essential lawmaking powers, like the power to tax, which is what tariffs are to the president.
So the court would be telling Congress you delegated too much and the White House you took too much.
Essentially, yes. It would be a major reassertion of congressional authority, albeit prompted by the court.
And the economic stakes of this, they sound almost unbelievable.
They are truly astronomical. The government expects to have collected somewhere between $750 billion and maybe even $1 trillion in these tariffs by next June. $1 trillion.
So if the court says they were illegal?
The standard judicial remedy would be to order a refund. Imagine trying to implement a refund program of that scale. Millions of businesses, complex customs claims. It would be an unprecedented administrative and financial nightmare for the Treasury Department.
And then there's the political fallout, the risk of a genuine constitutional crisis.
The risk is definitely there. It's palpable. The president sees these import taxes not just as revenue, but as fundamental tools for reshaping the U.S. economy, bringing back manufacturing. He's been very clear about that.
And he hasn't always bowed to judicial rulings he dislikes.
Exactly. Given his past hardline stance on executive power, if the court orders this massive refund, there's a serious, maybe speculative, but real risk he could refuse to comply. He might argue the court is interfering with a national security imperative.
Which puts Roberts in an incredibly tough spot.
He has to weigh the integrity of the judicial branch against the potential for this unprecedented standoff with the executive branch. He has to try and build some kind of consensus on a policy the president has framed as absolutely foundational.
He's tried to steer the court on presidential power cases before, hasn't he?
He has. He's emphasized that he wants to drive decisions in these kinds of cases, viewing it as essential for the court's institutional integrity. But his ability to fully dictate outcomes isn't what it once was, especially with the clear conservative majority.
So he has to thread a very fine needle.
Define the boundaries of the presidency without igniting a political firestorm that could damage the court itself. The sheer scale of the money involved and the president's intense commitment make this a truly era-defining case.
Okay, from the stress in D.C., let's pivot to the stress in the financial world. The stock market's reaction to that shutdown deal ending. Well, it seems to be pouring fuel on this deep split in the American economic experience.
Yeah, while Washington was arguing about paying federal workers, the stock market was already celebrating the hope of a resolution. And that relief rally, combined with the ongoing, just staggering artificial intelligence boom, is fueling what we're now calling this two-tier or split-screen economy.
The rally was pretty broad, wasn't it?
It was significant. The S&P 500 jumped 1.5%. The NASDAQ, which is tech-heavy and had just had its worst week since April, bounced back strongly, up 2.3%. Even the Dow added 0.8%.
But the real engine here, the thing driving the split, is AI, right?
Clearly. The IT and communication services sectors led the charge, continuing this almost unbelievable year-long trend. You saw companies like Palantir up nearly 9%, NVIDIA up almost 6%, AMD up over 4.5%.
And the wealth creation is just immense.
According to a recent JP Morgan Chase report, just the gains in 30 top AI-related stocks alone have added something like $5 trillion to household wealth in the U.S. in the past year.
$5 trillion is hard to even grasp. And that's the main driver of this split-screen economy.
Mm-hmm.
You should probably define the mechanism, the wealth effect.
Right. The wealth effect is key to understanding this split. It's the idea that when people's assets, especially stocks, go way up in value, they feel richer and more secure, so they spend more.
Even if it's just paper wealth.
Exactly. Economists usually estimate that for every $1,000 your stock portfolio gains, you spend an extra $35 to $50. And this confidence, this paper wealth, is translating into some major spending for people who own those assets.
The anecdotes in the paper really illustrate this. Tell us about the guy who bought a Porsche.
Yeah. The examples are perfect. There's Scott Hyde in Houston. He pulled $115,000 out of his S&P 500 fund after it gained a massive 73% in 3 years.
Wow.
And he used about $23,000 of that gain to buy a 1999 Porsche 911, a dream car paid for almost entirely by market appreciation.
Nice work if you can get it.
Or Rick Wichman in Massachusetts. His portfolio ballooned, so he replaced his old Toyota by leasing a new Tesla. And when a basic HVAC unit failed, he didn't just replace that one unit. He decided to replace the entire system for the property. Cost $72,000.
These aren't small purchases. They're big, confident expenditures.
Driven by that wealth effect. But that confidence is starkly contrasted with the mood of the rest of the country.
How so?
Well, sentiment among Americans who do not own stocks is, believe it or not, at the lowest level on a three-month moving average since the University of Michigan started tracking this back in 1998.
Lowest ever.
Lowest ever on that metric. And remember, those huge market gains disproportionately benefit the top 20% of earners. They hold something like 87% of all stocks and mutual funds.
So if you're not in that top slice,
you're just feeling high inflation, high interest rates, and getting zero boost from the market rally. It creates this weird social and economic tension.
And corporate earnings are reflecting this split, too.
Absolutely. You see it clearly in travel and dining. Delta Airlines, they reported their wealthier travelers are still paying record amounts for premium seats, first class, business class.
But economy is down.
But revenue from standard economy tickets actually fell. Same story at Chipotle. The CEO explicitly noted that their low to middle income customers are coming in less often, eating at home more to save money. Meanwhile, brands that cater to higher income folks are still doing fine. The economy is just running on two completely different tracks.
This wealth effect, while it's powering some sectors, it also makes the overall economy kind of vulnerable, doesn't it?
It creates a serious fragility. Forecasts suggest consumer spending might rise about 2% this quarter. But economists figure that maybe 3/4 of that increase is directly because of the wealth effect from stock gains.
So if the market turns,
if the AI boom hits a snag, or profit-taking picks up, or the market just cools off, that drop in perceived wealth could hit consumer spending hard and fast, potentially undermining the whole basis for current economic growth.
Okay, speaking of economic pressures and affordability, let's shift to this new and, frankly, pretty controversial housing proposal coming out of the administration. They're reportedly working on introducing a 50-year mortgage.
Yeah, this is definitely aimed at tackling the affordability crisis, especially for first-time buyers facing high rates. The explicit goal is to make it easier to qualify for a loan by drastically lowering the monthly payment.
The paper gives an example. A $400,000 home, 80% loan, 6.22% rate. The 50-year mortgage would cut about $200 off the monthly principal and interest compared to a standard 30-year. I mean, $200 a month back in your budget sounds really appealing up front, right? Couldn't that help more people buy homes?
That's the pitch, and $200 a month is tempting. But the financial mechanics behind it suggest it's much more like a debt trap than a path to wealth.
How so?
While you save $200 now, the long-term reality is just brutal. Over the full 50 years of that loan, the homeowner would end up paying approximately $335,000 more in total interest compared to the 30-year mortgage.
$335,000 more.
That's the number. It's a staggering amount of extra interest.
And what does stretching it out that long do to building equity? That's supposed to be the point of owning a home.
It absolutely crushes equity growth, especially in those crucial early years. You know how amortization works with a 50-year term? You spend the first decade, maybe longer, paying almost entirely interest. You build equity at a glacial pace because your principal payments are spread so thin for so long.
And we haven't even talked about the interest rate itself. Would lenders actually offer the same rate for a 50-year loan as a 30-year?
That's highly unlikely. That $200 monthly saving assumes the rate is identical. But lenders will almost certainly charge a higher interest rate to compensate for the added risk of extending the loan term by two whole decades.
So the rate hike could wipe out the savings.
It could easily erase that modest monthly saving entirely. You could end up with the maximum long-term debt and minimal short-term relief. It's kind of the worst of both worlds.
Beyond the individual finances, what about the broader societal impact if these became common?
That's a huge concern. It could fundamentally shift the idea of homeownership from being a primary way to build wealth into just a perpetual debt obligation. Think about it. The median age for a first-time buyer is around 33.
Right.
A 50-year mortgage means they'd be 83 years old when it's finally paid off. Many might never pay it off. Analysts worry we'd create a system where people pass down mortgage debt to their kids instead of equity and assets. That's a massive reversal of the traditional American dream.
And just the sheer length of that commitment must increase risk, right? Life happens over 50 years.
Absolutely. An extra 20 years dramatically increases the chances of major life events, divorce, job loss, health crises that make it hard to keep paying. It tackles the symptom, high monthly payments, but it seems to severely worsen the underlying issue of long-term financial stability and wealth creation.
Sounds like a policy driven more by political appeal than sound financial logic.
It certainly has that feel. And given our theme of institutional stability, promoting something that could weaken generational wealth transfer and increase consumer fragility seems, well, counterproductive.
Okay, let's move from consumer finance to the giants of the corporate world. There's a lot of focus on succession at one of the most watched companies anywhere, Berkshire Hathaway. Warren Buffett is trying to manage the transition to his successor, Greg Abel.
Right. Buffett is 95 now, and he knows the market hangs on his every word, his persona. There's that Buffett premium baked into the stock price. So he wrote this letter saying he'll keep a significant amount of his Berkshire Class A stock until shareholders get comfortable with Abel running things.
Adding that he thinks that confidence shouldn't take long.
Exactly. It's clearly designed to calm investor nerves, especially after his longtime partner, Charlie Munger, passed away in 2023.
And we're seeing concrete steps in the handover, too.
We are. Abel is stepping into roles that have huge symbolic weight. He's going to start writing the famous annual shareholder letter. For decades, that letter has been more than just a corporate report. It's been Buffett's platform on management, economics, ethics. It resonates way beyond Berkshire investors.
And the annual meeting.
Abel will lead the annual meetings starting next year. Buffett will apparently sit with the directors. It's a clear visual signal of the leadership change.
But despite all these reassurances, the paper notes Berkshire shares have actually slumped a bit since the succession was first announced. What does that tell us?
It just highlights the unavoidable truth that the Buffett premium is shrinking. Investors have paid more for Berkshire stock, partly because of the chairman's unique reputation, his track record, the trust he inspires. As he steps back, some of that intangible value naturally fades.
But the underlying business is still strong.
Oh, definitely. The company reported really solid third quarter results. Earnings were up 17%, and maybe most significantly, they hit a new record for cash on hand, $358
billion. $358 billion in cash. That's an incredible war chest. What's the thinking behind holding so much cash?
Analysts mostly see it as Buffett strategically leaving the big decisions, the big purchases, to Abel. It's kind of an implicit vote of confidence. He's preserving maximum flexibility, ensuring Abel has a huge amount of capital to deploy when he's fully in charge. It looks like a very careful, planned, gradual handover of the investment reins.
Interesting. It shows even in a financial giant, the human element, the trust factor, is still critical. Now, the next corporate story is less about people and more about pure infrastructure strain, driven by that AI boom we discussed.
Yes. The massive build-out of AI infrastructure, specifically data centers, is putting enormous visible pressure on the power grid. And that's leading to a political backlash.
Who's leading that charge?
Democrats, notably Senators Bernie Sanders and Richard Blumenthal. They're publicly blaming the explosion of data centers for rising electric bills. National electric bills jumped 5.1% in September compared to a year earlier.
What's their core argument? Why blame data centers?
It's basically about fairness and resource allocation. They argue these huge data centers often get big tax breaks and other help, but their power demands are just immense.
So they're hogging the power.
That's the argument. It effectively forces average Americans into, as they put it, bidding wars with trillion-dollar companies to keep the lights on at home. Rising electric bills are a real pain point for consumers, adding to inflation woes.
This really highlights a clash between wanting economic growth from AI and having the infrastructure capacity to support it.
It absolutely does. Now, electric price hikes have many causes, grid upgrades, fuel costs, weather, but data centers are applying intense pressure in specific areas. The development is simply outpacing the utility's ability to build new power generation and transmission lines fast enough.
So local grids are struggling.
In areas with lots of data centers, yes. Local utilities are having trouble guaranteeing enough power, which forces them into accelerated, very expensive grid upgrades. And guess who ultimately pays for those upgrades?
The average ratepayer.
The average ratepayer stigmatizes it.
And what's the administration's stance on this energy crunch?
They're taking a clear pro-development position, pushing hard to fast-track federal permits for data centers, speed up getting them connected to the grid, and crucially, their strategy focuses on powering this expansion with traditional sources, natural gas and coal.
While cutting renewable subsidies.
While slashing renewable subsidies, yeah. They seem to view renewables as maybe an obstacle to the rapid, reliable power expansion needed for the AI build-out.
Are the developers just waiting for the grid to catch up?
Some aren't waiting. We're seeing some major developers actually starting to push back against relying solely on the traditional grid. They're building their own power sources, maybe small natural gas plants or huge solar farms dedicated just to their data centers.
Taking matters into their own hands.
Exactly. Trying to avoid the regulatory delays and the supply chain issues of relying on utilities. It suggests the AI industry's power needs are so massive, it might actually force a fundamental change in how commercial energy is generated and distributed.
Before we jump fully into global affairs, let's quickly hit a few other key corporate points from the paper.
Sure. The AI cloud market strength is really shown by CoreWeave. They're a top provider in that specialized space. Their revenue more than doubled just in the third quarter.
Wow. What else?
In the drinks world, the spirits giant Diageo brought in a consumer industry veteran, Dave Lewis, as CEO. His job is basically to revitalize the company because demand has been faltering in key markets like the U.S. and China. People's tastes seem to be shifting away from some of their premium spirits.
Tough challenge. Any big deals?
On the M&A side, yes. The private equity firm KKR made a significant sale. They sold Novaria Group, which is a key supplier for aerospace and defense, to another buyout firm, Arcline, for $2.2 billion in cash.
Okay. Any crypto?
Coinbase launched something interesting, a new platform letting individual investors buy digital tokens before they get listed on the main exchange. It's a way to tap into that speculative frenzy around pre-listing tokens, giving retail investors access usually reserved for institutions.
Okay, interesting. Now, shifting abroad, that theme of institutional turmoil and friction definitely continues. We've got two really explosive stories involving major U.S. allies and adversaries. First, that deepening investigation into the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage.
Yeah, this story is genuinely destabilizing for the Western alliance supporting Ukraine. German police and federal prosecutors now believe they have a pretty clear picture. They think an elite Ukrainian military unit carried out the pipeline bombing back in 2022.
An elite Ukrainian unit.
That's what the evidence suggests. And furthermore, it points to the operation happening under the direct supervision of Ukraine's then Supreme Commander, General Valery Zaluzhny.
How do they piece this together? The investigation sounds complex.
Incredibly detailed, almost like a spy novel. The German team followed this extensive evidence, trail tracking suspects using boat rentals, burner phones, even automatic speed trap photos from across Europe. And controversially, they used commercially available facial recognition software.
And that led them to someone.
It led them to identify a Ukrainian veteran named Sereti K. He was subsequently arrested in Italy after a silent alert was put on his passport when he crossed the border.
This puts Ukraine's backers, especially in Europe, in a really difficult position.
Massive political strain, particularly for Poland and Germany. Poland, for instance, has reportedly refused to extradite one of the suspects they hold, seeing him as a hero for hitting Russia's finances.
And Germany.
The pressure is intense on German Chancellor Friedrich Merz. Remember, those bombings really cemented high energy prices and economic pain in Germany. Now they have evidence it might have been orchestrated by an ally they're heavily supporting.
And the extradition decision for Sereti K in Italy becomes critical.
Hugely critical. If Italy extradites him to Germany to face charges, it could cause a major rupture between Ukraine and Germany. Germany is Kyiv's biggest financial backer, providing essential military gear, especially air defense systems.
What was the suspected motive behind the bombing, according to the investigation?
It seems dual. One, cut off Russia's oil and gas revenue that funds the war. Two, permanently sever Russia's economic leverage over Germany. But this investigation forces Germany into a terrible choice. Pursue justice for an attack on its own infrastructure or risk damaging a critical wartime alliance.
Okay, shifting diplomatic gears completely now. A massive, rapid realignment seems to be happening in the Middle East involving Syria.
This is a huge development. Syrian President Ahmed al-Shara, he's the leader who removed Bashar al-Assad last December. He actually met President Trump at the White House on Monday.
A Syrian president at the White House. That's unprecedented, isn't it?
First time ever. It signals a dramatic U-turn in U.S.-Syrian relations.
What came out of the meeting? Any immediate changes?
Syria announced it intends to join the global coalition to defeat ISIS, the de-ISIS coalition, becoming the 90th member. And in return, the U.S. will let Syria reopen its embassy in Washington. This allows for more coordination on counterterrorism, security, and even economic issues.
So the U.S. sees this new leader as someone they can work with.
U.S. officials seem to view Shara as the best bet for a stable Syria. The hope is to transform Syria from this driver of instability under Assad into a more cooperative partner.
The ambition here sounds enormous, according to the paper.
It is. It's an explicit, ambitious White House effort to pull Syria away from traditional U.S. adversaries like Iran and Russia and the remnants of the Assad regime. They want to align Syria more with Washington, the Gulf Arab states, and Turkey.
So normalizing relations with a controversial new regime to isolate Iran.
That seems to be the strategic calculation. It shows a willingness to engage if it serves that larger goal of isolating Tehran and achieving some kind of long-term regional stability.
Okay, from high-stakes geopolitics, let's move to pasta. There's apparently a trade crisis brewing that Italian exporters are calling pasta pasta, America.
Yes. It sounds niche, but it's a classic example of how protectionism can clash with technical trade laws, often with punitive results. The U.S. Commerce Department has hit Italian pasta brands with duties totaling an incredible 107%.
107%?
Yeah.
How?
It's a combination. There's a 92% anti-dumping duty slapped on 13 Italian companies, including big names like La Malissana. Plus, there's the administration's existing 15% tariff on pretty much all EU imports.
So combined, it makes exporting impossible.
That's what the Italian exporters say. It makes selling pasta in the U.S. totally non-viable. They're apparently already preparing to pull their products off American shelves maybe as early as January.
Okay, but that 92% anti-dumping duty, what's the justification? Something about untranslated Italian words. That sounds bizarre.
It sounds bizarre, but this is where we get into the weeds of anti-dumping law. It relies on something called adverse facts available, or AFA. The Commerce Department claimed these 13 companies were uncooperative with its investigation.
Uncooperative how?
The specific complaints included problems with documentation, like untranslated Italian words in key accounting files, and some missing data points on production costs. When Commerce decides a foreign company is being uncooperative, the law lets them use AFA.
Which means?
Which means they can basically apply the highest possible duty rate they found for any company that did cooperate, or even a rate from a totally different past case. It's meant to be punitive to encourage cooperation.
So, because of translation issues and maybe some missing data, Commerce just assumed the worst and applied this massive 92% penalty.
That's essentially it. They based that huge tariff on the assumption that two key companies, La Molisana and Garofalo, were representative of the whole group. They invoked AFA and hit them with the highest possible margin.
The Italians must be furious.
They argue the commerce analysts didn't understand Italian accounting practices, maybe mistaking net prices for gross prices, simple errors used to justify the punitive rate. They see it as unfair.
Do they think it's political?
Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's government certainly does. They've mobilized a diplomatic task force to fight it, calling the tariffs disproportionate and a violation of trade norms. If this stands, it could devastate major companies like La Malissana, which relies heavily on the U.S. market. It's a clear example of trade tensions spilling into diplomacy, with the Italians viewing it as protectionism wrapped in technicalities.
Okay, one more international friction point.
Yeah.
The media industry. The BBC is apparently facing a full-blown crisis after a lawsuit threat from President Trump.
Yeah, this is a big one. President Trump threatened a massive $1 billion lawsuit against the BBC. It's over a recent documentary by their flagship investigative show, Panorama.
What was the issue with the documentary?
The BBC admitted that the documentary spliced together two different parts of Trump's January 6, 2021 speech. These parts were spoken nearly an hour apart. But the editing made it look like he was calling for violence at the Capitol immediately before the riot began.
Which was highly misleading.
Extremely misleading, and the BBC admitted it. The institutional fallout was immediate and pretty devastating.
Who resigned?
Both the BBC Director General, Tim Davie, and the CEO of BBC News, Deborah Turness, resigned after the admission. The BBC chairman, Samir Shah, issued a rare public apology calling the editing an error of judgment.
This must play into broader criticisms of the BBC's impartiality.
Absolutely. This debacle reflects much wider scrutiny the BBC has faced for years from all sides of the British political spectrum about its ability to remain impartial.
Were there other issues mentioned in the paper that contributed to this erosion of trust?
Yes, the paper notes that an independent ethics advisor had actually flagged this edited footage along with other significant impartiality concerns before the lawsuit threat. For example, there were internal complaints that the BBC News team's LGBTQ desk was suppressing reporting that didn't align with liberal views on transgender issues. And their Arabic language service was also criticized for running stories seen as overly credulous towards criticism of Israel. The fact that top leadership resigned and there's a billion-dollar lawsuit hanging over them really highlights the huge financial and reputational risk when a public institution is perceived as failing its core standard of impartiality.
Okay, let's shift gears now to U.S. national security. The paper paints a pretty stark picture, suggesting the U.S. is kind of stuck in peacetime mode while China is operating on a wartime production footing.
That's the incredibly blunt warning from Seth G. Jones in his new book, The American Edge. He argues the U.S. is in a wartime environment, meaning a great power competition with existential stakes, but its defense industrial base is still functioning like it's peacetime. And this mismatch, he says, is a critical failure that needs immediate attention before the gap with China becomes impossible to close.
He provides some statistics about China's buildup that are just startling.
They are absolutely chilling and should be a massive wake-up call for the Pentagon and Congress. The most jaw-dropping one. China now has 232 times the shipbuilding capacity of the United States.
232 times.
It reflects a scale of national prioritization and resource allocation that's just on a different level. Jones also points out China is maybe 10 to 15 years ahead of the U.S. in being able to deploy fourth-generation nuclear reactors at scale. That's a huge advantage for energy and potentially future naval power.
This deficit, Jones argues, happened because the U.S. missed a key strategic opportunity called the third offset. Can you quickly explain the offset strategies for our listeners?
Sure. The offset strategies are basically historical U.S. military doctrines. They aim to regain a strategic advantage when conventional strength is matched or surpassed, usually by leveraging superior technology.
Okay.
The first offset, back in the 1950s, relied on nuclear weapons, massive retaliation, to counter the Soviet Union's much larger conventional army in Europe. The second offset, starting in the 70s and 80s, used smart technology things like precision-guided bombs, stealth aircraft, advanced surveillance to gain a conventional edge over the Soviets.
And the third offset was supposed to be next.
The third offset was meant to be the integration of newer technologies like AI, drones, advanced cyber warfare designed to create dominance against peer competitors like China and Russia today. But Jones argues the U.S. basically fumbled this window. After 9/11, the focus shifted heavily to counterinsurgency in the Middle East.
While China focused on scaling up its industry and military AI.
Exactly. China kept its eye on the ball of great power competition, while the U.S. got bogged down elsewhere.
So what's the solution Jones proposes now to close this gap?
He calls for a full-scale mobilization of the private sector, kind of echoing the arsenal of democracy effort during World War II. The strategy has to be to rapidly harness the innovation power of private companies. He mentions entrepreneurs like Elon Musk, Palantir's Alex Karp, Anduril's Palmer Luckey.
Use their tech.
Use their breakthroughs in AI and drone technology, mass produce them affordably, and get them deployed at scale. He argues the private sector has the answers. The government just needs to adopt and scale them with wartime urgency.
It's a huge challenge, involving scale, speed, and overcoming bureaucratic hurdles. A real test of U.S. institutional agility. Now, staying on domestic safety but shifting focus, we find another kind of infrastructure failure. Outdated federal flood maps.
Yeah, this is a major public safety and financial failure, driven by, frankly, obsolete government systems. Oh. Flooding is the costliest natural disaster type in the U.S. But the federal maps used to assess that risk, they're often 10 years old or even older.
And they only use historical data.
They rely only on historical data. They don't incorporate forward-looking climate change projections, which in today's world is just a massive oversight.
How big is the overlooked risk? How many properties are we talking about?
The data provider First Street estimates that the federal maps miss nearly 13 million properties across the country that actually have the same flood risk, a 1% or higher chance each year, as properties officially inside the designated federal flood zones.
13 million properties whose owners probably think they're safe.
Exactly. And this failure has immediate, sometimes tragic consequences.
Like what?
Well, in cities like Chicago, residents outside the official flood zones, like one homeowner Shirley Howard mentioned in the paper, have had their basements flood with raw sewage because the city's stormwater systems get overwhelmed during intense rain events the old maps didn't account for.
Awful.
And near Asheville, North Carolina, deadly flash floods during Hurricane Helene hit numerous homes where lenders hadn't required flood insurance simply because the properties were just outside the lines on those outdated federal maps.
And if people outside the zones don't have insurance because the maps are wrong, who picks up the tab when disaster strikes?
We do. the taxpayers. When people lack coverage, the cleanup and recovery often fall heavily on FEMA disaster aid. That costs taxpayers an estimated $12 billion a year. It's an unsustainable cycle made worse by the government's inability to keep its risk assessments current with climate reality.
Why does it take so long to update these critical maps?
It seems to be sheer bureaucratic inertia, plus the genuine complexity of environmental modeling. The paper says it can take FEMA 6 years or even longer just to finalize new flood zone boundaries.
6 years.
When, given how fast the climate is changing, that process really should take maybe 2 years max.
Yeah.
This delay leaves far too many people with known significant flood risk completely unaware and unprotected.
Okay, lastly, on the safety front, there's tragic news out of New Delhi.
Yes, sadly. A fatal car explosion occurred in a densely populated neighborhood near the historic Red Fort Monument on Monday. The blast killed at least 8 people and injured 20 or more.
Do they know the cause?
Police are still investigating. They're trying to determine if it was some kind of catastrophic car fuel issue, like an accident, or potentially a deliberate suicide attack. The U.S. Embassy issued a warning advising citizens to avoid crowded areas as several Indian states remain on high alert after the incident.
Okay, let's pivot now to personal health. Some significant news here. A long-standing, very serious caution has been removed from hormone therapy drugs. This could really change things for millions of women.
This is a huge development, yes. It seems driven by updated clinical science and maybe a correction of what some felt was historical alarmism. The FDA has told manufacturers they can remove those prominent black box warnings from hormone replacement therapy, or HRT, drugs.
The black box warning is the most serious kind, right?
It is. And the FDA commissioner noted that those original warnings, which came largely from that big 2002 Women's Health Initiative study, the WHI study, well, they may have unfairly scared many women away from what could have been life-changing treatment for menopause symptoms.
What was wrong with how that 2002 study was interpreted? It caused a huge drop in HRT use.
The WHI study did find an association between HRT and a slightly increased risk of breast cancer. That's what prompted the warning. But the FDA commissioner specifically pointed out that, on reanalysis, that original finding wasn't actually statistically significant. Plus, doctors now understand that the small risk observed was mostly linked to a specific type of synthetic hormone used in that trial, one that doctors have largely moved away from now, often preferring bioidentical hormones. And the study itself focused on older women who started therapy years after menopause began, which kind of skewed the risk profile upwards.
So what's the current thinking? What's the new recommendation for women considering HRT?
The consensus now among medical professionals is that women should ideally start HRT within 10 years of menopause onset. When started then, HRT, usually a mix of estrogen and progesterone, is highly effective at relieving those often debilitating short-term symptoms. Hot flashes, night sweats, severe mood swings, joint pain.
And the risks.
The consensus is that the risk of breast cancer and other serious issues primarily applies to women who start the drugs much later, like after age 60. So the timing of when you start seems key. This FDA reversal is really critical validation for doctors who've been carefully prescribing these therapies for years based on newer evidence.
And related to managing menopause, there's also a growing trend in using tech to track symptoms during the lead-up phase, perimenopause.
Yes, perimenopause. Doctors sometimes describe it clinically as a sputtering car. The ovaries start unpredictably releasing hormones, causing all sorts of confusing effects. Sleep problems, random joint pain, anxiety, hot flashes.
Sounds unpleasant.
It can be really disruptive. Mm. So new tracking apps like Natural Cycles, Flow, the Oura Ring are emerging as really useful tools. They help women, typically in their 40s, track these often misdiagnosed symptoms and correlate them with things like their cycle patterns or basal body temperature.
What's the interesting medical insight here? What do doctors find most valuable?
It's interesting. Doctors often find the consistent symptom tracking from these apps more useful for diagnosis than trying to check hormone levels. Hormone levels fluctuate wildly day to day during perimenopause, making blood tests often kind of useless.
So the log is better than the lab test?
In many cases, yes. A consistent, tracked symptom log helps a physician figure out exactly what kind of treatment or intervention might provide the most relief for that individual patient.
How are these apps specifically tracking perimenopause?
Well, apps like Natural Cycles, which is already FDA cleared for birth control, are using complex algorithms now. They estimate the user's stage of perimenopause early, middle, or late based on age, heart rate variability data from wearables, and the symptoms the user logs.
That sounds pretty sophisticated.
It provides a level of personalized data that can be really validating for women who often feel confused or dismissed when they describe their symptoms. One woman in the article said the app helped her realize her intense irritability was directly linked to her hormonal shifts, making her feel less crazy and more validated. Being able to download and share a clear report with your doctor is becoming a really valuable tool.
Okay, let's move from health tracking to the sports world. Apparently, the NFL is having its funkiest, most unpredictable season in years.
Unpredictable might be an understatement. It's genuinely bizarre. You look at the playoff picture, and three teams that were considered total long shots before the season started, the Patriots, the Colts, the Broncos, they're leading their divisions, all with impressive 8-2 records.
What were their odds?
To give you an idea, the Patriots were like 80-1 long shots to win the Super Bowl. The Colts were 100-1. Nobody saw this coming.
And meanwhile, the teams everyone expected to dominate,
they're struggling. The Kansas City Chiefs, usually a powerhouse, are just middling along at 5-4. The Baltimore Ravens are 4-5. It's upside down.
The betting markets must be confused.
Totally scrambling. Despite their record, the Chiefs are somehow still the technical betting favorites for the Super Bowl, which just shows how muddled the whole league landscape is. Parity, or maybe just widespread mediocrity, seems to be the rule this year.
And all this confusion leads to a really interesting MVP debate, focusing heavily on the Indianapolis Colts running back, Jonathan Taylor.
Taylor is having an absolutely monster season, historically dominant. He leads the entire NFL in three key categories: rushing yards, 1,139 so far, yards per carry, a huge 6.0, and total touchdowns, 15.
He just had a massive game too, right?
Just rushed for 244 yards, including this spectacular 83-yard run in overtime, broke the Colts' all-time career touchdown record. Statistically, you could easily argue he's the most valuable offensive player in the league right now.
The conventional wisdom says he probably won't win MVP.
Unfortunately, yes. He's running smack into the league's intense, decades-long preference for quarterbacks. The modern NFL just revolves around the QB. It's the glamour position, the perceived mission-critical role, and MVP voters almost always reflect that bias.
Who was the last non-QB winner?
Adrian Peterson, way back in 2012. It's been over a decade. So unless Taylor absolutely shatters every single rushing record imaginable, voters will almost certainly find a way to give the award to a quarterback. Maybe Matthew Stafford, maybe even the rookie Drake May, just because of the position they play.
So even if he's the most dominant player, he gets a consolation prize.
He'll likely win the NFL Offensive Player of the Year award, which is kind of unofficially known as the Too Bad You're Not a Quarterback trophy. Saquon Barkley got it last year after a great season. It's just this institutional bias that's really baked into the voting.
Okay, finally, we end the paper with something completely different, wonderfully eccentric: the race to grow a 3,000-pound pumpkin.
Yes, this is a fantastic glimpse into this world of agricultural obsession and high-stakes gardening. The world record for the heaviest pumpkin has been broken 21 times just since 1993. It hit 2,819 pounds this year.
And now the goal is 3,000 pounds.
That's the magic number hobbyists are pouring enormous resources into reaching.
It sounds less like a hobby and more like, I don't know, an elite sport.
It basically is. Growers spend thousands on special proven seeds. They use high-tech tracking, like genealogy tools. There's this database run by an IT worker named Andy Corbin that tracks the family trees of thousands of giant gourds.
Seriously, pumpkin genealogy.
To find the best genetic lines, they hand-pollinate the flowers, install heating cables in the soil to keep the temperature just right, build these elaborate shelters, pumpkin palaces, to protect them from sun and control humidity.
This sounds expensive.
Some dedicated growers spend up to $15,000 a year just on supplies and gas to haul these monsters to the regional weigh-off competitions.
But even with all that science and money, there's still a lot of luck involved.
That's what the pros admit. They still call it a roll of the dice. Apparently, the gene pool for these super pumpkins is now so incredibly inbred that the genetic difference between a seed that grows a 2,300-pound pumpkin and one that could potentially hit 3,000 pounds is tiny.
So genetics aren't enough?
Not entirely. Even while they track lineage religiously and optimize everything they can control, factors like tiny microclimate shifts, getting rain at the perfect time, and just plain old good luck are still huge factors in who wins in this highly competitive, wonderfully absurd world of giant pumpkin growing.
What a day. I mean, looking back across everything we covered, that theme of institutional stress just keeps popping up, doesn't it?
It really does. You had Washington struggling to govern itself amid these deep party divisions. You have the economy clearly splitting into one part booming from AI wealth, the other part really struggling. And global systems trade, alliances buckling under pressure from tariffs and sabotage investigations.
Yeah, the systems we kind of rely on, political, economic, even physical things like flood maps or the defense industrial base, they're all showing these deep fissures, these strains.
Yes, exactly. You have the highest court potentially reining in presidential power significantly for the first time in years, the Senate tearing itself apart internally, citizens relying on FEMA maps that are dangerously out of date and can't cope with today's climate reality.
So given all that institutional stress, all that disruption we've talked about, here's the provocative thought we want to leave you, the listener, with today.
What established institution or maybe even shared reality that you rely on today might be quietly eroding or being undermined right now, setting us up for trouble next year or the year after?
Think beyond the obvious political fights.
Yeah, consider something like the stability of basic trade relationships. We saw it in that pasta tariff story, right? Where political frustration gets weaponized through technical trade law, potentially disrupting supply chains for everyday goods.
Or what about the integrity of scientific health advice? The FDA just reversed itself on a decades-old black box warning for hormone therapy after years of debate and evolving evidence. What does that do to public trust long term?
The ground beneath many of our major institutions just seems to be shifting faster and faster these days. It's definitely something to keep an eye on.
It is indeed a compelling question to mull over. We certainly hope this exhaustive deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Tuesday, November 11th, 2025, has been useful, maybe an invaluable shortcut to staying informed.
Thanks so much for joining us.
We'll see you next time for the Deep Dive.